From Simon & Schuster Audio, Tom Clancy, SSN. Based on the CD-ROM from Simon & Schuster Interactive. Narrated by Joe Morton, with Boyd Gaines as Captain Mac Mackey.
From the New Military Times, June 1997. Though the name may sound obscure, the Spratly Islands have been a cause of conflict in East Asia for quite some time. Sovereignty over all or part of this potentially oil-rich archipelago in the South China Sea is presently contested by Vietnam, China, Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Taiwan. Although the Manila Declaration by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in 1992 promised to resolve this dispute peacefully, the nations involved have yet to arrive at a consensus about the future of this territory. In the past few months, tensions have mounted between the East Asian nations, and the need to have the United Nations serve as a mediating force has been suggested. Many of the countries involved have stationed troops on the islands, and some have begun to build their own infrastructures, causing further disagreements. The dispute over the Spratly Islands has served as a further impediment to healing many of the rifts existing within East Asia. This issue needs to be addressed on an international level before it escalates into higher forms of conflict.
From TCN in Washington, this is a news brief. I'm Jim Collins. It's Tuesday, July 19th, 1997, and leading our news tonight, Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping is dead. The death of the 92-year-old Deng was announced just hours ago by China's official Xinhua news agency. Deng had been frail for many years and was confined to a military hospital for most of the past 18 months. Deng's hand-picked successor is President Jiang Zemin, who has been waiting in the wings to assume full power. Jiang supports Deng's policy of slowly opening up China to Western-style capitalism, but his position is threatened by Premier Li Peng, the hardline Marxist who wants to roll back Deng's economic reforms, which he claims are destabilizing the country. It was Li Peng who authorized the brutal crackdown on dissidents in 1989 in Tiananmen Square. For the moment, there is an uneasy calm in China. Meanwhile, Houston-based United Fuels Corporation has announced the discovery of huge oil deposits in the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. The stock market reacted quickly. United Fuels was up nearly $13 in heavy trading this afternoon. Still, some analysts are urging caution, citing the conflicting territorial claims of the surrounding nations. China, of course, is one of those nations claiming sovereignty over the Spratlys. Jim Collins, TCN News.
July 23, 1997. The New Military Times web posting from 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. From Washington, Chief Correspondent Michael Flacetti reports. In a stunning development, Premier Li Peng has staged a coup d'etat and gained control of the Chinese government in the early hours of this morning. Aided in the coup by General Yu Kuili, leader of the so-called Petroleum Faction, Li has apparently ordered the arrest of Jiang Zemin, president and successor to the late Deng Xiaoping. Jiang's whereabouts are unknown. He is presumed to be in hiding. In a statement issued today, Li, a conservative with broad support from both the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese military, said that rampant capitalism and greater economic ties to the West threatened to undermine the national focus of China, and that it was time that the people of China stood together in a common cause. Precisely what that cause is remains to be seen.
From TCN in Washington, this is a news brief. I'm Jim Collins. Exactly 1 week after the death of longtime leader Deng Xiaoping, a Chinese naval assault force has boarded and seized an American-flagged vessel, the oil exploration ship Benthic Adventure. Under international law, the seizure represents an act of war. At the same time, Chinese military forces have occupied the long-contested Spratly Islands. Both Vietnamese and Philippine forces, which had established a presence on the islands, were quickly overrun by the Chinese Navy in the course of the two-day campaign. Many analysts feel that the invasion has significant tactical motivations, as well as economic. One senior Pentagon aide commented today that the Spratlys give the Chinese a staging ground for the South China Sea. There is also widespread concern that the Spratly Islands may be utilized to mount an invasion of Taiwan, which China has never recognized as a sovereign nation. Taiwanese President Lee Teng-hui has appealed to the United States for military support, echoing requests made in 1996. The president has made no statement on the situation. He is said to be conferring with the UN Security Council before passing comment. No question, though, that tensions are extraordinarily high, verging, according to some sources, on a state of war. Jim Collins, TCN News in Washington.
The USS Cheyenne, a Los Angeles-class nuclear attack submarine, cast off the tugboat's lines at precisely 0100 hours on 12 August 1997 and moved under its own power into the dark waters of San Diego Bay.
Left 5 degrees rudder. Left 5 degrees rudder, I see.
Her crew had performed admirably during her shakedown cruise, but now she was on high alert and headed into trouble. She was on her way from her berth at the Ballast Point Naval Submarine Base to the Pearl Harbor Naval Submarine Base to complete her outfitting. From there, she would take up station in the South China Sea.
Rig for dive. Let's look sharp, men. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there.
Captain Bartholomew Mac Mackey was pleased with both his ship and his crew. A big man, Mac had been engineering officer of an earlier 688. And he was a rising star in the Navy. 2 years deep selected for commander and 2 years deep selected for captain. Mac was a real captain, not just in terms of the Navy tradition of referring to a commanding officer as captain, but in pay grade as well. Cheyenne was the newest attack submarine in the U.S. Navy. She was also the last of an era. Given the hull number SSN-773, Cheyenne was the last of 62 Los Angeles-class nuclear attack submarines to be funded by Congress. Built by Newport News Shipbuilding in Virginia, Cheyenne was 360 feet long and displaced 6,900 tons. She was equipped with the latest advanced weapons and sensor systems and was prepared to accomplish whatever missions the U.S. Navy would task her with. Cheyenne's pressurized water S6G General Electric nuclear reactor had been critical for some time, and when she reached the deep water west of Point Loma, sailors from the sonar room to the torpedo compartments confirmed that all was well. Captain Mackey knew his crew had heard the rumors of a possible war with China, and he knew the rumors were true. As of 2 August, when an American submarine had sunk a Chinese Han-class nuclear attack submarine in defense of the U.S. aircraft carrier Nimitz, a virtual state of war had existed between the U.S. and China. Cheyenne submerged, slowly at first, and then more and more quickly. When she was underwater, the OOD, officer of the deck, began the transit by turning the submarine in a southwesterly direction, the most direct route for Pearl Harbor. With the ship underway, Mac was able to concentrate on the main obstacle to his mission: the possibility that Chinese nuclear attack submarines might be lurking along his path. His orders were clear. If Cheyenne were to come into contact with a Chinese vessel, she was to proceed with the utmost caution and attack only in defense of herself. In other words, Cheyenne was free to fire only if she was fired upon first. The U.S. was not officially at war yet. Yet being the operative word. Once Cheyenne arrived at Pearl, she was to load up on weapons and food needed for the possibility of a long cruise, one that could turn into a combat operation.
I
There was not much room on a submarine for storing food, so crates containing canned goods were loaded into the passageways, one on top of the other, temporarily raising the floor. As the crew consumed the food, the floor would grow lower. Until then, the passageways would be dangerous places for taller members of a submarine crew. As Captain Mackey walked toward the tiny wardroom he'd be using as the briefing room, he grinned at the thought that everything from canned tomato sauce to string beans was stored beneath his feet. Entering the wardroom, Mack motioned to his officers to sit.
As you are all aware, we are currently in a highly tense environment due to the recent hostile actions taken by the Chinese military. I would just like to inform all of you that we received a message that a Canadian P-3 Orion, operating on a training mission out of San Diego, thinks that they may have picked up a submarine 237 miles southwest of our current position. They lost contact after tracking the submarine for about 20 minutes. The P-3 crew is pretty confident that what they found was an SSN. Naval intelligence thinks it may be one of the Chinese Han class of nuclear attack submarines, but they haven't been able to confirm anything up to this point. We've been instructed to keep our ears open for this possible contact while at the same time proceeding as fast as we can to Pearl so that we can arrive safely on station in the South China Sea. We are to avoid taking any actions against the submarine, unless, of course, he tries to kill us.
The officers took this news in stride, and while the meeting was not as rousing as the captain had hoped, it had gotten his point across. Word would soon be buzzing all across Cheyenne that they would be on the lookout for a nuclear attack submarine lingering far too close to U.S. waters for comfort. For her transit to Pearl Harbor, Cheyenne was given a small loadout of torpedoes. The full capability of her torpedo room was 26 weapons, including four in the torpedo tubes, consisting of a combination of Mark 48 torpedoes, Tomahawk cruise missiles, land attack and anti-ship varieties, Harpoon anti-ship missiles, and sometimes, though rarely, Mark 67 submarine-launched mobile mines. However, for this transit, Cheyenne was given only 12 Mark 48 ADCAP torpedoes. With a top speed of over 50 knots while running deep and a range in excess of 30,000 yards, the Mark 48 ADCAP, which stood for Advanced Capability, was arguably the best heavy torpedo in existence. It weighed over 3,000 pounds. Nearly 20% of its weight, or 650 pounds, consisted of PBXN-103 high explosive. One of the advantages of the Mark 48 was that it could be used against both submarine and surface targets, which made it much easier on logistics. Each Mark 48 was wire-guided, so that targeting data during the initial stages of a torpedo launch could be transmitted back and forth from the Mark 48 to the Busy One fire control system on board the attack submarine. During the terminal stages of the attack, the Mark 48 would use its powerful active seeker to detect, home in on, and then destroy its target. As long as the wire was intact, information from the torpedo was constantly relayed to Cheyenne until detonation. After the meeting, Mack returned to the control room. Instead of running at 26 knots for much of the way to Pearl Harbor, as he had originally planned, Mack ordered that Cheyenne would slow more frequently in order to listen to her surroundings. This sprint and drift technique was one of the best methods of arriving at a destination quickly, while also allowing the submarine's passive sonar to search for any possible contacts. Running at 26 knots was not always quiet. The screw, known to those outside the Navy as a propeller, was working feverishly to propel the submarine at this speed. This created tiny air bubbles which made a popping noise when they collapsed, a noise known as cavitation. It would give away a submarine's position to enemies. At this moment, Mack did not care as much about his stealth capability as he did about his two other concerns: locating the submarine that might be lurking dangerously near the West Coast, and arriving at the Pearl Harbor Naval Submarine Base with Cheyenne intact. At 1100 hours on 12 August, just 10 hours after leaving San Diego, the officer of the deck ordered Cheyenne to slow to one-third. Exactly 11 minutes later came a message from the sonar room.
Con, sonar, tonal contact, center bearing 187 on the end fire beam.
The sonar supervisor took his information from his console screen, which resembled a computer screen with green lines running through it.
Con, sonar. We have a possible submarine contact, bearing 187. We're only receiving blade rate information so far.
Mac entered the sonar room, joining the five of the men already there.
If there's a Chinese submarine patrolling this close to our coast, it's got to be a Han class. That's the only type they've got that could travel this far from home waters without surfacing. At least it's the only one we know of.
Mac ordered the sonar contact designated Master One. Each contact attained on a U.S. Navy submarine by combining one or more signals or sensors was given a master designation. China's submarine fleet, Mac knew, consisted primarily of older model diesel boats that were incapable of such a journey. And he was well briefed on the latest intelligence regarding the Han-class subs. According to those reports, construction of the Han-class had stopped after only five submarines due to extremely high internal radiation levels, and they were all currently in service with the Chinese Navy. They carried the pennant numbers 401, 402, 403, 404, and 405 painted on their sail. One of the class had been destroyed earlier that month by a U.S. SSN. Naval intelligence was still unsure which number it was, but they reported that it was probably number 402, the second of the class. They were assuming this because it had been tracked since leaving Ningbo Naval Base in China's East Sea Fleet 4 days prior to the actions involving Nimitz. The torpedo complement fitted to the Han class was reported to be a mix of the older straight-running types, as well as some of the newer Russian homing varieties. According to the reports, numbers 401 and 402 carried only torpedoes, but the last three submarines of the class, numbers 403 to 405, carried the Ying-Ji. Also known as the Eagle Strike, this anti-shipping missile was a sea skimmer and caused naval commanders great concern. The most recent intelligence reports stated that while these missiles could be a significant threat to warships, the submarine needed to surface in order to launch them. And submarine commanders knew all too well that a surfaced submarine was an easy target.
Captain, it's possible the submarine was tracking us but lost us when we slowed. With these convergence zones out here in deep water, it could be in excess of 75,000 yards away. My guess is that he thinks we passed him. Based on its blade rate, he's running full speed in an attempt to catch up with us and regain contact.
That was a good guess, Mac thought. But it was still just a guess. We wanted something more than that. Proceeding to the con, he ordered the officer of the deck to station the section fire control tracking party so the Busy One computers could be used to determine the firing solution on the target. The OOD would maneuver the submarine in order to change the bearings received by the towed array. The towed arrays were strings of hydrophones that collected data for the sonar system. Mac also ordered the OOD to house the TB-16 towed array and deploy the TB-23 towed array. Unlike the 240 feet of the TB-16 hydrophones, the TB-23 towed array measured over 900 feet in length, mounted nearly 100 hydrophones, and was towed at the end of a 2,600-foot cable. Mac returned to the sonar.
Captain, blade rate indicates Master One's speed is steady at 18 knots. We're getting more tonals now, including from the conformal array. She's definitely not American. The tonals compare to those listed in the sonar intelligence manuals as unique to Chinese Han class, number 402.
I thought number 402 was sunk by the submarine escorting Nimitz.
So did naval intelligence. I guess they got their numbers mixed up. Wouldn't be the first time.
Mac turned and called to the OOD.
Begin retrieving the TB-23 towed array. I don't want to get tangled up in case we have a fight on our hands.
Then he left the sonar room and went back to the con to see how the fire control solution was coming. 7 more minutes passed.
Con, sonar. Master One just stopped his shaft.
Cheyenne's sonar operators carefully monitored the tonals from the Chinese submarine's reactor coolant pumps. These had to be run constantly in order to avoid destroying the reactor, which was one of the few drawbacks of the nuclear-powered submarine.
Con, sonar. Single active pulse from Master One. And there's another one.
Mac took the con from the officer of the deck.
Man battle stations, torpedo.
With battle stations manned, the executive officer in his role as the fire control coordinator reported to the captain.
Master One is now bearing 169. Busy One range is 22,000 yards. He is not in a convergence zone.
On board Han number 402, the Chinese commander felt that he had little choice but to give his position away. His sonar had only acquired intermittent contact on the American submarine maneuvering in this area, and he needed to locate it in order to accomplish his mission: sink the submarine and then continue on against American merchant ships. He knew an American submarine was out there, but he didn't know where, and he didn't know it was Cheyenne. Unfortunately for him and his crew, however, he had thought that he was much closer to the Americans than his active sonar told him he was. 22,000 yards was out of torpedo range for his submarine, but not for Cheyenne's Mark 48s. Those two active pings were a calculated risk on the Chinese captain's part. He knew his submarine was as noisy as a bull in a china shop, and he suspected the Americans had been tracking him. Once he'd figured out that the American submarine had passed him, he knew they could not be far off. If he waited too long, he would miss his chance to attack. On board Cheyenne, Mac was trying to outguess the Chinese captain. He knew that Chinese submarines were notorious for having very poor sonar outfits, but he didn't think they were bad enough that the captain of number 402 would have no choice but to use his active sonar, giving away his own exact location. Mac's thoughts raced through the possibilities.
No, this does make sense. If the Chinese captain knew we were tracking him, he probably has figured that we knew his location. So all he was really doing was leveling the playing field, giving away information we already had in order to learn our location as well.
This meant that the Chinese submarine had gone active on the Cheyenne, and both submarines now had an accurate firing solution. Mac didn't expect the Chinese captain to let this opportunity slip away. The Han was currently outside its own torpedo range, but that could change rapidly.
Khan, sonar, the Han just started up again. It's making turns for 25 knots. Sounds like she's really straining. They're closing quickly.
Captain Mackey reversed course to minimize the range closure and readied his torpedoes.
Torpedo room, fire control. Make tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects and open the outer doors.
When the outer doors were open, Mac turned back toward the Han and increased speed to full. Both submarines were headed straight for one another in an underwater game of chicken that could potentially bring about a third world war.
Khan, sonar, we have a torpedo in the water. Type set 53, bearing 163. It's active, Captain.
Captain, range to Master 1 is 21,000 yards.
Mac looked around his control room. There was a look of horror in the eyes of the young sailors who had not yet been in the Navy for 6 months. He turned to his helmsman.
All stop.
All stop. Aye, sir. Maneuvering answers, all stop.
The normal procedure for countering a torpedo was turn and run, flank speed, in the opposite direction. This was not, however, a normal situation. The U.S. intelligence community had managed to secretly buy 3 of the Chinese Set 53 homing torpedoes from the Russians in a not-so-friendly transfer of technology. From their various tests, they had determined that the maximum range of the Set 53 was 5 nautical miles, or 10,000 yards. Even building in a large margin of error by doubling that range to 10 miles, or about 20,000 yards, Mac knew that there was simply no way that the Chinese torpedo could hit Cheyenne. It did, however, make Captain Mackey furious, and not just because this was an act of war against the United States by a Chinese submarine. More than that, this was an aggressive action against him, his submarine, and his crew. Cheyenne was not in any immediate danger, not yet at least. Just in case, however, the captain calmly issued another order.
Rig ship for depth charge.
The Chinese captain had put his submarine in a very bad position. The Chinese leaders, wanting to demonstrate their power to the Americans, had given Han number 402 orders to attack American submarines and surface ships operating in the area. The 402's captain was following his orders faithfully, but he didn't believe those orders included suicide. And he knew all too well that attacking a Los Angeles-class submarine was tantamount to suicide. If he could manage to get in close enough to attack Cheyenne, he would do so. If not, he would follow his orders and launch at whatever range he felt he could without getting himself killed. Then he would dive deep and hunt for American merchant ships. When the active pings revealed Cheyenne's location, the Chinese captain realized that he had given away their location much too far away to effectively attack the Americans. With their own location revealed, closing with Cheyenne would put the Han at serious risk, which meant that his only real choice was either to simply turn and run, or to first shoot at the American and then turn and run. The first option appealed to him the most, but the second option was what his orders demanded. The Han captain had given the command to release a single torpedo and then began turning to his right. His only plan was to make a turn to the east and get away from the now angry American submarine. Mac immediately saw what the Han was doing. It was turning and running in the direction of San Diego, which could only mean one thing. China was at war with the U.S.
Con sonar. The Chinese torpedo just settled dead in the water. Based on runtime, didn't even make it 6,000 yards.
Mac nodded.
Okay. They've had their turn. Now it's ours.
The Los Angeles-class attack submarine began to pick up speed rapidly, rushing to get behind the Han. The Han's top speed was 25 knots. Cheyenne was doing 31 knots. And the range to Master One closed rapidly. Both commanding officers knew it would only be a matter of time before the Americans were within firing range. On board the Han, the Chinese captain's options were limited once again. He could continue to run, prolonging things for a short while longer, or he could turn and fight. His orders were clear, and so was his choice. At his command, his submarine came around in another slow turn and bore down on Cheyenne. It was a noble gesture, but a futile one. The Han captain was racing to get within torpedo range, knowing that the effective range of the American Mark 48 ADCAP is more than double that of his Chinese Set 53.
Con, sonar, two torpedoes in the water, more Set 53s, bearing 165.
Captain, range to Master One is 18,000 yards.
Mac wasn't worried. Clearly, the Chinese had done this out of desperation. They wanted to go down fighting, and their only hope was to get lucky. And a torpedo in the water was a chance to get lucky. A torpedo unlaunched was nothing. Cheyenne had closed to within striking range, but Mac didn't give the orders to shoot yet. There were still two chances for the Chinese to get lucky, if those Set 53s really had a range of 20,000 yards.
Rig for depth charge. Launch two noisemakers.
The noisemakers were officially known as ADC Mark II decoys. ADC for Acoustic Device Countermeasure. They were launched out of mini torpedo tubes and were designed to decoy incoming torpedoes in a direction other than that of the Cheyenne. In this case, they accomplished exactly what they were intended to do. The Chinese torpedoes ran out the length of their course without hitting anything south. Mac had trained nearly his entire career for firing on an enemy submarine. He had never really expected it to happen. But now, he gave the command.
Firing point procedures. Master 1, tubes 1 and 2. Match sonar bearings and shoot. Tubes 1 and 2.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2. Aye, sir.
As soon as the torpedoes entered the water, the Chinese submarine began to turn. Mac guessed that they were going to try a 90-degree turn away from the Mark 48s. The secret heads on the ADCAPs were doing what they had been designed to do, hunt down an enemy submarine. They stayed with the Han as it twisted and turned. The combat systems operator reported their progress.
Both torpedoes have acquired Master One.
Both Mark 48s had found the enemy submarine with their own sonars and no longer needed to be guided by the wires that connected them to the Cheyenne's fire control system. Mac replied,
"Cut the wires, shut the outer doors, and reload tubes 1 and 2.
on sonar. Two explosions bearing 162.
Captain Bartholomew Mackey did not join his crew's cheers. Cheyenne had just scored her first blood, but Mack knew that more than that had just happened. War with mainland China was now real.
From TCN in Washington, this is a news brief. I'm Jim Collins. The crisis in the South China Sea is now a war. Yesterday, a second Chinese submarine was destroyed by the U.S. nuclear sub Cheyenne. In the wake of that attack, China's Premier Li Peng, who took power in a sudden coup just days ago, has entered into a shooting war with the United States. He announced today that China will immediately retaliate against U.S. forces in general and against the Cheyenne in particular. With us tonight is former Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Jeb Thomas. Admiral, what can you tell us about this matchup? Can China launch a significant attack against our Navy and against a nuclear sub like the Cheyenne?
Technologically, the Chinese have nothing that we know of that can match our nuclear submarines. If you were to describe the forces in terms of decades, we are in the 90s and the Chinese are in the 50s. Their submarines are slow, diesel-powered, under-weaponed, and they have little or no ELINT capability.
What is ELINT, Admiral?
Electronic intelligence. Sensors, advanced sonars, subsurface eavesdropping. Technologies that are vital to modern submarine warfare. But the Chinese are not without advantages. Their submarines may be old, but they have an awful lot of them. And they're operating in their home waters, so to speak, with short supply lines. This is no cakewalk. Ultimately, what's going to decide a conflict like this is the ability and the will of the forces who are doing the fighting.
Thank you, Admiral Thomas. Our forces are at war. The whereabouts and fate of deposed Chinese President Jiang Zemin are still unknown. Hardline communist Li Peng and his even harder-line ally General Yu appear to be in control of the world's most populous nation. It is, on one level, a confrontation of China's superior numbers versus the superior technology of the United States. But as Admiral Thomas pointed out, it is really a war between people, not between machines and faceless masses. The cost will be determined in human lives, and the outcome is very much in the balance. Jim Collins, TCN News.
Cheyenne's first loadout in Pearl Harbor included 16 Mark 48 ADCAPs, 6 Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles, and 4 Harpoon anti-ship missiles for medium-range attacks on surface ships. The loading was a long process. The Mark 48s had to be slowly and carefully lowered into the loading hatch one at a time, and the Tomahawks in their loading canisters had been loaded directly into Cheyenne's vertical launch tubes. Cheyenne was ordered to rendezvous with the USS Independence, which was heading for the now-occupied Spratly Islands. The long transit across the South Pacific from Pearl, through the Celebes and Sulu Seas in Indonesia, and finally into the South China Sea, proved to be far from peaceful. The Chinese destroyer had sunk an American merchant ship en route to Hawaii. Cheyenne diverted from her journey long enough to seek and achieve revenge on the destroyer. In the process, the SSN encountered and sank a Chinese Romeo-class diesel submarine. Entering the South China Sea, an encounter with a Chinese task group resulted in 4 more kills for Cheyenne, 2 Ming-class attack submarines, and 2 more Romeos. With her reputation and kill numbers rapidly growing, Mack knew that his ship was marked by the Chinese Navy. Then, as the Cheyenne neared the rendezvous point in the southern end of the South China Sea, new orders came in over the deployed floating wire. Mack read the orders after the document printed out in the radio room. He immediately called his officers into the wardroom.
Gentlemen, I've called this meeting to pass on our new orders. From our present position in the South China Sea, we are to proceed to the north of the Chinese-held Spratly Islands. Once there, 300 miles north, we will launch 6 Tomahawk land attack missiles at the Chinese submarine base, which has recently been set up near Quarteron Reef, one of the islands in the Spratly chain. As you all know, naval intelligence has reported large numbers of Chinese submarines operating in this area. We've confirmed this with our own detections. Our new orders are to do something about that.
Mac paused, making sure that everyone was paying full attention.
We are going to enter the belly of the beast. We will launch our Tomahawks as ordered, and then we will meet up with the submarine tender USS McKee in order to rearm.
After fielding a few questions, Mac dismissed the meeting and returned to the con. He used the 1MC, the general announcing system, to inform the rest of the crew of their new mission. From there on out, Cheyenne would use sound-powered phones instead of the 1MC. 45 minutes later, Cheyenne went to periscope depth, just long enough to receive preliminary Tomahawk cruise missile targeting data. This information, which they would confirm when they got closer to their launch position, would be fed to their cruise missiles prior to launch. ...350 miles southwest of Quarteron Reef, running at 425 feet, Cheyenne picked up her first contact. Mac was in the sonar room meeting with the sonar supervisor.
Captain, we have a sonar contact bearing 020 on the spherical array. The contact's intermittent, so I think we're receiving the sound source via a convergence zone. We pick her up loud and clear, then we lose her and don't hear anything for a while.
While normal sound travels through the water in waves that are at least somewhat predictable, there are some areas in which sound waves are turned up toward the surface and then bounced back into the sea. These are called convergence zones. Their motion allows sonar detection at far greater ranges than would otherwise be possible. The sonar supervisor continued his report to Mac.
My guess is that it's in the second convergence zone from us.
That would put the signal's source at a range of more than 60 miles, or 120,000 yards. Mac nodded.
All right, designate the contact Master 24. Keep an eye on that contact.
If the sonar supervisor was right, and Cheyenne's operators had indeed heard their sonar contact through a convergence zone, then the signal's source was far out of Cheyenne's weapons range. But if the sonar supervisor was wrong, Cheyenne could be in for some very dangerous close combat. 63 miles away, 200 feet below the surface of the South China Sea, crept one of the newest additions to the Chinese fleet, and one of China's best submarine captains. The Chinese Kilo submarine had been in service for less than 2 years, and she had been making her crew very proud. The first Chinese Kilo submarines had been bought from Russia in 1993 and delivered in February 1995. The Chinese had planned on buying up to 15 of these powerful diesel submarines and had hoped that they would be able to build 5 more themselves, under license from Russia. This particular submarine had excellent equipment, with the exception of her passive sonar outfit. The Kilo's Chinese captain reflected that the Russians didn't seem capable of making a decent passive submarine sonar, at least not one that his country would be allowed to buy. And that was a problem. At any given moment, there might be an American Los Angeles-class submarine sneaking up on his position, and he would never know it until it was too late. He wasn't too worried about it, though. His was the lead ship of 3. Below the waves, his Kilo was working in tandem with an older Romeo-class diesel submarine. Above them, the Jinan, a Luda-class destroyer, patrolled the surface. Their mission was to hunt down and destroy any American ships and submarines. In addition, there was another Kilo well off to the side, not part of his task force, but it could provide assistance if he needed it. Back on board Cheyenne, Mac was in the control room, looking at the Busy One fire control console.
Sonar, Khan, have you regained contact on Master 24?
Khan, sonar. We're working on a possible contact, but I'm not sure it's the same convergence zone. This one may be a surface ship. Master 24 was tentatively classified as a submerged submarine.
Several minutes later, the sonar supervisor reported that he had not one contact, but two. One Romeo submarine and one Luda destroyer, both bearing 020. They were both given new master numbers, designated masters 25 and 26 respectively, since the sonar supervisor was not sure if either one was master 24. Reconstruction would have to sort it out later. The OOD ordered his section fire control tracking party manned. Mac leaned into the sonar room.
Anything else out there?
Not that we can tell yet, Captain, but those two contacts are loud. We can hear them orally, so there could be more ships operating in the area.
Mac went back to the control room, still unaware of the Kilo's presence. The Busy One operators had a rough solution on range of the destroyer and the Romeo, about 30,000 yards. At Cheyenne's current speed of 10 knots, Mac would soon be within range to launch his Mark 48 ADCAP torpedoes at the Chinese contacts. When he got closer, he would slow. No need as yet for long-range shots. Cheyenne was currently running with the TB-23 towed array fully deployed, and with the OOD's maneuvers, the section fire control tracking party at the Busy One computers were getting better and better solutions on the Chinese destroyer and submarine. Then the sonar supervisor announced another player.
Con sonar, the TB-23 just picked up a helicopter overhead, probably flying from the Chinese destroyer.
Take her down fast to 500 feet.
Throughout Cheyenne, sailors grabbed for whatever they could as the submarine headed down at a 20-degree angle. Above them, the Chinese Z-9A Hilo hovered and began to lower its powerful dipping sonar using a hydraulic winch.
Con, sonar. We just received a sonar pulse from the helicopter's dipping sonar. It's a French type, HS-12, same kind they sold to China. The transmission came from the opposite direction of the Romeo. I don't think they could have detected us, sir. Signal level of the pulse was low.
1 hour and 15 minutes later, Cheyenne had closed to within 20,000 yards of her targets, masters 25 and 26. Mac ordered battle stations manned. In a few more minutes, the Hilo was active again.
Con, sonar. That was a loud one. She got us on that one, sir. But that's not all she painted. Captain, we've got another submarine out there, a Kilo class, one six-bladed screw, making turns for 10 knots. It's bearing 025, near the same bearing as the Romeo. It's been hiding from us all this time.
Considering the situation, Mac was pleased with how well his officers and crew were handling the sudden tension. The Kilo was designated Master 28. Cheyenne had just been pinged on by a directly overhead Chinese anti-submarine warfare helicopter, which had undoubtedly received an exact fix on their present location 500 feet below the surface. The Hilo would now probably be making an MAD, magnetic anomaly detection pass, to confirm Cheyenne's position. Mac was concerned that they would follow that up by dropping a torpedo directly on top of Cheyenne.
Con, sonar, the Kilo, Master 28, just picked up speed. It's heading directly at us, making turns for 17 knots. They must suspect that the Hilo gave their position away.
Fire control, what's the range to the Kilo?
24,000 yards, Captain. We're within ADCAP range for the Kilo. It's making lots of noise at 17 knots. Recommend making tubes 1 and 2 ready.
Mac nodded and initiated firing point procedures on Master 28. Moments later, a Mark 48 was fired from Cheyenne's first torpedo tube. But before the combat system officer could report on the torpedo's status, the sonar supervisor reported in.
Con, sonar, torpedo in the water, bearing 180. It's a Chinese Mark 46 copy, Mod 2.
Cut the wire and shut the outer door. Reload tube 1.
Mac was throwing away his torpedo and he knew it. The Kilo was too far away and maneuvering. The Mark 48 would probably not be able to acquire on its own, but right now, Mac had a different torpedo to worry about.
Left full rudder, all ahead flank. Steady course 305. Cavitate. Make your depth 750 feet. Rig ship for depth charge.
Cheyenne's power plant was now running at peak capacity in an attempt to get away from the deadly torpedo racing their way.
Con, sonar, another torpedo in the water. Master 27 just dropped a second Mark 46 on us, bearing 245.
Release a noisemaker.
Cheyenne's top speed was nearly 40 knots. The two torpedoes chasing her were knifing through the water at 40 knots. But Mac wasn't worried. Not yet, anyway.
Captain, torpedoes bearing 268 and bearing 187.
If Mac maintained his course and speed, the torpedoes would both run out of fuel before they closed the distance. The problem was that at flank speed, Cheyenne was making more noise. She was announcing her exact location to every nearby sonar device. On top of that, she was making enough noise that she could barely hear anything around her. Mac knew that in order to outrun the torpedoes, they would need to keep running at this speed, blind to anything but the noisy torpedoes, for at least another 5,000 yards. That was when Cheyenne caught her first break.
Con, sonar, the first torpedo just fell for the noisemaker. It's off our tail.
Sonar, Con, what about torpedo number two?
Con, sonar, it's at the edge of our port baffle. Hold it. It just went active, Captain.
Release another noisemaker.
The tension level slowly mounted.
Con, sonar, the Mark 46 just latched onto the noisemaker decoy. Lost the torpedo in our baffles.
Mac nodded. The Chinese Mark 46s were fast, but they were easily fooled.
Ahead one-third. Sonar, report all contacts.
Mac wanted to know who was out there and exactly where they were.
Con, sonar, we've got three contacts, Captain. One Kilo-class submarine bearing 278, making turns for 15 knots. One Romeo-class submarine bearing 020, making turns for about 6.5 knots. The third contact is a Chinese Luda-class destroyer, which is probably where that helo came from, bearing 350. The destroyer is also heading in our direction. The TB-23 doesn't hold the helicopter above us, which may be because we're too deep. But my guess is that it's rearming onboard the destroyer.
Mac would be sure to mention his sonar supervisor in his patrol report. The Busy One operators confirmed the sonar supervisor's expert calls. The Romeo was previous Master 25. And the Luda was previous Master 26. However, the Kilo's bearing was too far to the left for it to be the previous Master 28, which Cheyenne shot at earlier. Master 28 was added to the kill list, and the new Kilo was designated Master 29. Mac went for the last one first. The new Kilo, Master 29, was the closest target and potentially the quietest. And Mac wanted it out of the picture.
Torpedo room, fire control. Make tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects and open the outer doors.
Tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects.
Outer doors are open, sir.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tube 2, Master 29.
Tube 2 fired electrically, sir.
Con sonar, unit from tube 2 running hot, straight, and normal.
The Kilo knew the moment the torpedo entered the water. It tried to turn and run in the opposite direction, but the Chinese submarine had little chance. The Kilo had been closing on Cheyenne at top speed, and with a torpedo heading its way, it didn't have much room to maneuver. The Kilo zigged and zagged, tossing its crew about as the Chinese captain tried to confuse the torpedo at the same time that he tried to reverse his heading. The Chinese submarine released a noisemaker decoy to buy time, but none of his actions worked. The 650-pound explosive warhead had literally peeled open the Kilo's back end, beginning with its screw. The Chinese Kilo would roam the sea no more. Mac didn't pause to save the victory. He wanted the destroyer, Master 26, next. With luck, the Kilo would still be on board, but the Cheyenne had to be closer to the surface to launch a harpoon missile.
Reload tube 2 with a harpoon. Diving officer, make your depth 100 feet.
The Luda II-class destroyer was a fairly large target, so Mac was going to fire two weapons at it. He would have preferred to make them both harpoons, but Cheyenne had already fired three of her four anti-shipping missiles in previous actions. He would have to attack the Luda with only one harpoon and one Mark 48. The torpedo had a bigger warhead, but it also had a much shorter range.
Fire control, what's the current range to the destroyer?
Range to Master 26 is 30,500 yards, bearing 354.
And what's the range on the Romeo?
Busy One computes 28,000 yards, sir. Master 25 is not moving. I think they figure that if they move, we'll hear of them and kill them, sir.
Mac ran through the situation in his mind and quickly made his decision.
Make tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects, including opening the outer doors. Firing point procedures. Tube 2, Master 26. Tube 1, Master 25.
Moments later, torpedo tube 2, containing Cheyenne's last remaining UGM-84 harpoon, fired. Tube 1 was fired as soon as the ejection pump ram had returned to battery. The Romeo wasn't as quick as the Kilo. It took them 2 minutes to realize there was an enemy torpedo coming through the water at them, and several minutes longer to increase their speed. And by then, it was simply too late. The Luda-class destroyer Genon, however, was a different matter. The harpoon was very fast, covering the 17 miles to the Chinese destroyer in less than 3 minutes. The Chinese sailors launched a cloud of chaff to try and decoy the missile away from the ship. When that failed, and the harpoon began its final descent, the Genon manned its twin 25-millimeter guns and began firing into the air, putting up a wall of steel in front of the harpoon. Years earlier, Saddam Hussein had tried that unsuccessfully around Baghdad against U.S. Tomahawk land attack missiles. It didn't work any better for the Chinese sailors. The harpoon slammed into the vessel directly underneath its anti-ship missile launchers, impacting downward and tearing a large hole in the hull.
Khan, sonar, we hit the destroyer bad, sir. I'm hearing breaking up noises already.
Torpedo room, what about the Mark 48?
Impact in 4 minutes, Captain, but it's a lock. That Romeo's not doing much to get out of the way.
Mac was pleased, but he wasn't satisfied. He ordered tubes 3 and 4 readied, then fired another Mark 48 at the damaged destroyer. Tube 3 was fired electrically, but sonar didn't have the chance to report on the torpedo's status before the Romeo was hit. The old, antiquated reserve submarine had tried to evade, tried to flee, but Cheyenne had it outgunned and outmaneuvered.
Khan, sonar, we have the sounds of a submarine filling with water. Master 25 is sinking, sir.
Mark 48 has acquired Master 26, sir.
Mac ordered the wire in Tube 3 cut, Tube 4 secured, and Tube 3 reloaded with a Mark 48. When that had been done, he gave the command to take Cheyenne deep once more. Moments later, the crew heard the death knell of the already damaged Chinese Luda 2 destroyer. Now Mac was satisfied. The harpoon might have been enough to sink it. Now, however, the destroyer went down with all hands and both helicopters on board. Mac gave the order to secure from battle stations. 10 hours later, Cheyenne was approaching her launch point north of the Spratleys. When she was 7 minutes away, Mac ordered the SSN brought to periscope depth to confirm her location and receive any new orders. This also gave them a chance to verify the targeting information they'd downloaded earlier. With everything confirmed, Cheyenne proceeded to her launch point and prepared to launch 6 Tomahawk land attack missiles at the Quadron Reef submarine base. 2 of the Tomahawk missiles were the UGM-109D varieties. These would be able to take out soft targets and destroy electronic sensors and early warning systems protecting the base. The remaining 4 were fitted with a 1,000-pound bullpup warhead that was designed to take out the base headquarters and the piers where the Chinese submarines were being rearmed and refueled. One by one, Cheyenne launched her missiles and then slipped deeper into the sea. She would now have to wait on word from naval intelligence to determine if her mission was a success.
Diving officer, make your depth 500 feet. Let's get out of here before they know what and who hit them.
Mac was pleased. His crew had performed well. Cheyenne had carried out her mission, and now they were heading toward the Sulu Sea. The submarine tender McKee would be there waiting for her, ready with supplies and armament for Cheyenne's next assignment. Max secured from battle stations once more, hoping it would be the last time this trip.
August 10th, 1997. The New Military Times web posting from 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. From White House correspondent Susan Hayes. Swift reaction from around the world today followed the announcement from the White House that an American submarine dealt a severe blow to Chinese submarine forces in the Spratly Islands. In a brief statement to reporters, White House Press Secretary Stan Oakley noted that the missiles were fired by the nuclear attack submarine Cheyenne. He said that the action will deny the Chinese military a local resupply and refueling point for their warships and airplanes. In response, China's UN Ambassador Wu Tai issued a surprise announcement of his own, stating that, quote, "The People's Republic of China will not tolerate interference by Western powers in its affairs." He called the U.S. attacks unprovoked and declared it, quote, "an act of war that will not go unchallenged." He then announced that China had acquired advanced nuclear submarines of her own to replace those that have been lost in the conflict thus far. No comment yet from the White House or the Joint Chiefs on Wu Tai's revelation. But retired Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Jeb Thomas, in a commentary for TCN News, said that if what Wu Tai says is true, it could mean serious trouble for U.S. forces in the South China Seas. This would mean, in particular, the Los Angeles-class submarine Cheyenne, which has amassed a remarkable record of combat successes in the initial weeks of this conflict. Admiral Thomas pointed out that China's nuclear subs, if they do exist, are undoubtedly Russian-built Alpha-class vessels, which are faster than America's Los Angeles-class subs and capable of operating at greater depths. Does China have the hardware to back up Wu Tai's threats? We will undoubtedly know in the very near future.
Mac walked through officer country on board the submarine tender McKee, accompanied by his officers. Cheyenne was just completing her mini refit, and Mac and his officers had just completed their final briefing. The briefing had been professional and highly detailed. Mac came away with a clear sense of Cheyenne's mission. The orders were simple: unrestricted submarine warfare on Chinese submarines and surface warships, with the main targets expected to be those departing Kwajalein Reef. But no briefing was ever absolutely complete. The briefing officer could not pass along information she didn't have, and on the last day of Cheyenne's refit, naval intelligence had not discovered or, as sometimes happened, had somehow neglected to pass on the fact that there was a new player in the area. Once underway, Cheyenne proceeded at best speed to a location west of Kwajalein Reef. Overhead imagery had shown that the Chinese were stirring, probably preparing to deploy under cover of darkness, which was only hours away. Mac was ready.
Officer of the deck, Captain. Shift main coolant pumps to fast speed and then proceed to flank speed. Make your depth 409 feet.
Shift main coolant pumps to fast speed and then proceed to flank speed. Aye, aye, sir.
Cheyenne arrived northwest of West Reef shortly after nightfall, remaining outside the 100-fathom curve for the time being. Upon receiving the report from the officer of the deck that they were on station, Mac proceeded to the control room.
Make preparations to come to periscope depth.
After acknowledging the captain's order, the OOD slowed to two-thirds and brought Cheyenne up to 130 feet and cleared baffles.
No sonar contacts, Captain. Ready to proceed to periscope depth.
Cheyenne approached the 60-foot periscope depth smoothly. When the diving officer's count hit 62, the OOD called out,
"Breaking."
He quickly swung the periscope through a 360-degree arc.
No visual contacts, Captain.
There were a number of radar contacts chirping over the Type 18 ESM receiver, a passive receiver system designed to detect radar emissions. But the periscope wasn't picking up any visuals. Mac turned to the OOD.
Ahead one-third.
Khan, ESM, I have 5 ESM contacts. 1 a Chinese radar and 4 Russian radars. Hultec indicates a Han class, 3 Kilo class, and 1 Alpha class. The closest is the Han at signal strength 3 and increasing.
Captain Mackey and the OOD looked at each other with surprise. Mac turned to the microphone.
ESM, Captain. Are you sure about that Alpha?
Yes, sir, Captain. It's an Alpha. We've seen him, this particular one, in the North Fleet numerous times. No mistaking it, sir. He's well registered in our computer database.
Mac turned to the executive officer.
Draft a message report on the Alpha. Release it when ready. We need to find out what gives.
Right away, Captain.
The Alpha was designated Master 31, the Han Master 32, and the 3 Kilos Masters 33, 34, and 35. In less than half an hour, Cheyenne's flash message report had been sent and answered by the communicators at CTF 74, Commander Task Force 74, located in Yokosuka, Japan. Mac read the CTF message and filled in his executive officer on what he learned.
ESM is right. It seems the friendly Russians have sold a North Fleet Alpha to the Chinese, who then crewed it and overhauled it apparently at Quarteron Reef. How many more Alphas are being transferred to China is anybody's guess at this time. Naval intelligence is working on the problem. They're paying special attention to the recent lack of openness of the Russian submarine bases at Vladivostok and Petropavlovsk.
Mac called for an immediate meeting of all officers in the wardroom to share with them the new intelligence on the Alpha, manned by Chinese, and its current exodus with a Han and 3 diesel-class Kilos. He expected the SSNs to wait for deep water before diving, but anticipated the Kilos would dive in 20 fathoms. That was as far as Mac got before the OOD called him on the sound-powered phones.
Captain, ESM reports the Kilo radars and the Han radar have shut down. They were drawing left while the Alpha radar is still drawing right.
Okay, men. We have our work cut out for us. The 3 Kilos and the Han have probably submerged. And the Alpha may be trying to do an end-around to get behind us. It's time to man battle stations.
Mac's reading of the situation was correct. Sonar had just finished reporting tonals from the Han SSN to the Khan as the captain arrived and ordered the OOD to man battle stations torpedo. There was still nothing from the Kilos acoustically, but the Alpha had also shut down its radar, last bearing due south of Cheyenne. Mac passed the order to the torpedo room over the sound-powered phones.
Torpedo room, fire control, make tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects, including opening the outer doors.
The Han was drawing left and closing. It was not quiet by any means, and was easily tracked by the TB-16 spherical and conformal arrays at the same time. The inputs to the 3 busy one computers made the solution a snap for the fire control party. Soon, the busy one operator and the fire control coordinator were satisfied with the target motion analysis solution on Master 32, the Chinese Han-class attack submarine.
Firing point procedures, Master 32.
The combat systems officer reported the target's course, speed, and range.
Sonar, Khan, stand by.
Khan, sonar, standing by.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2, Master 32.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2, Master 32. Aye, sir.
Khan, sonar. Units from tubes 1 and 2 running hot, straight, and normal.
The 2 torpedoes executed their wire clearance maneuvers and accelerated rapidly to 50 knots en route to convergence with the Chinese submarine.
Sonar, Khan. Time to acquisition?
8 minutes, Captain.
To Mac, it seemed like an eternity before he heard the next report from the combat systems officer.
Unit 1 has acquired. Unit 2 has acquired.
Mac nodded, satisfied.
Cut the wires, shut the outer doors, and reload tubes 1 and 2.
Thank you. Explosions reverberated through the water, followed by the sound of the Chinese submarine breaking up.
Con, sonar, we have a torpedo in the water. Set 53, bearing 089.
Apparently, the Han CO had launched a snapshot at the bearing of the incoming torpedoes as part of a last-ditch effort prior to a certain death. Mac didn't hesitate.
Right full rudder, all ahead flank. Cavitate, make your depth 1,000 feet. Rig ship for depth charge.
Within minutes, Cheyenne was at flank speed on course 185 and at 1,000 feet. The bearing rate presented to the Chinese torpedo made no difference as the Set 53 locked on to the knuckle created by the Cheyenne's powerful maneuver. That was a direct result of Mac's order to cavitate, and the knuckle had formed over 1,000 yards away from Cheyenne's current position.
Sonar, two explosions, bearing 055, range 8,540 yards.
Chief of the watch, over the 1MC, secure from rig ship for depth charge. Secure from battle stations.
Mac knew that the stand down from the tension could easily be short-lived, especially if the Han had been accompanied by quieter kilo-class diesels running on their batteries. The officers adjourned to the wardroom for the captain's standard critique of the attack. Mac also had every battle station sonarman there. This review was very positive, but Mac added a note of caution about not allowing their guard down. This was war, he pointed out, and the Chinese shouldn't be expected to sit back and watch their submarine force be devastated. Cheyenne and her crew needed to proceed with caution back to an interdiction point so that they could detect and attack some of those kilos. Mac's plan was a good one, but it was circumvented by events. Even as he was critiquing their most recent battle, sonar reported regaining contact on the Alpha Master 31. The Alpha was proceeding north toward the sounds of the Han's demise, and Cheyenne's turn toward the south during the torpedo evasion nicely closed the range. Mac's attack on the Alpha started out the same as the attack on the Han. The outcome was different. The Alpha, with its 40 knot speed, was able to evade both torpedoes fired from the Cheyenne. The Chinese had learned to drive the Alpha, Mac realized, but fortunately, they still had things to learn about their submarine. If that had been a Russian crew on board, Cheyenne might have had to contend with their torpedoes. Now Mac wasn't ready to take on the kilo-class diesels, which were probably lurking in the shoals while communicating with the Alpha. So it decided to withdraw to the deep water to the northwest. From there, it could report the Han and Alpha attacks to CTF-74. It didn't need to return to the McKee yet, since Cheyenne still had 16 torpedoes to offload to the muzzle door at four Chinese submarines. And he had to complete the delouse of the area before Independence could steam north to the Spratlys. His message was quickly acknowledged by CTF-74. Who passed traffic from the submarine element coordinator and the anti-submarine warfare commander on board Independence. Cheyenne turned to the southwest and prepared herself for shallow water operations.
Con, sonar. Sonar contact bearing 195. Sounds like the Alpha, Master 31, coming back for more.
The captain ordered the towed array to short stay as Cheyenne ventured inside the 100-fathom curve south of Fiery Cross Reef. He intended to confuse the Chinese by operating in the shallow water. The Alpha SSN, he knew, would remain outside the shoals, unable to hear Cheyenne until, if things went according to plan, it was too late. A shorter-range attack would preclude the Alpha from responding and evading the torpedoes. Battle stations were manned once again as the range to the Alpha closed to inside 40,000 yards, and none too soon, as sonar reported transient noises bearing 125 and 135. As Mac had expected, the Alpha was out in the deeper water. The Chinese kilos had remained in the shoal waters, massing for guerrilla operations against Cheyenne. They could have been a problem, but Cheyenne was ready with two outer doors already open. Mac opened fire.
Snapshots, tubes 1 and 2, bearings 125 and 135 respectively.
That order meant that the Mark 48s would have to do their own thing in detecting, tracking, and sinking two of the kilos. It worked. The two torpedoes quickly acquired the kilos. The two diesel-class subs tried to flee, increasing speed and cavitating heavily, but to no avail. Both torpedoes found their marks and destroyed the kilos. But Mac wasn't satisfied.
Where's that third kilo?
Con, sonar, we have transients bearing 180 that sound like Christmas balls falling off a tree and breaking, like a tinkling sound. Seems that the third kilo was spooked by our torpedoes and ran into a coral reef.
Mac grinned. He was happy to take the kills any way he could. Only the Alpha remained, and Cheyenne had lost contact after the first explosion against the kilos. Sonar was not able to reacquire the Russian submarine, and Mac gave the orders to take Cheyenne out of the area. They'd have another chance at the Alpha, he hoped, before he had to submit the next patrol report. The only question that was bothering him was how the Alpha had slipped away. He hadn't expected that from a Chinese crew on a Russian submarine. Cheyenne moved into deeper waters. As she resumed her patrol, Mac found himself wondering whether the Alpha had acquired a Russian advisor, or, worse, a full Russian crew.
October 6, 1997. The New Military Times web posting from 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. From Pentagon Chief Correspondent Daniel Tanner. The question of the whereabouts of ousted Chinese President Jiang Zemin has become increasingly significant in recent days as the regime of Premier Li Peng appears to be crumbling. In the months since the United States imposed a total exclusion zone around the Spratly Islands, China's losses have mounted. Many of those losses have been inflicted by a single U.S. submarine, the Cheyenne. Torpedoes and missiles launched from the Cheyenne destroyed most of a Chinese supply convoy shortly after the total exclusion zone was imposed. A week later, when China launched a huge flotilla to attack the battlegroup of the aircraft carrier USS Independence, the Cheyenne was there again, countering the attacks of China's Russian-built nuclear submarines. There have been reports that many of these craft were staffed with Russian advisors. The extent of this staffing and the exact function of these personnel is not known. But the evidence of Russian involvement adds urgency to the question of Li Peng's continued presence as the head of state in China. If Jiang Zemin is alive, and if rumors of his presence in Taiwan are true, then his return to the mainland and to power would be a top priority for U.S. policymakers. Certainly the popular support is there. Li Peng's regime, while still commanding the loyalty of much of the military under General Yu Kuili, is the subject of open opposition in China. The setback suffered by China's military in the Spratly hostilities has left Li Peng in a highly vulnerable position. He is reportedly taking desperation measures, including escalating his arms purchasing from Russia. Newer, larger, more powerful nuclear submarines are apparently high on Li Peng's acquisition list.
From TCN in Washington, this is a news update. I'm Jim Collins. Reports tonight from the CIA and Naval Intelligence that new Chinese submarine forces have been spotted heading for the South China Sea. According to Naval Intelligence sources, these vessels include a number of the Russian-built Akula II submarines. There are also reports that one of Russia's most advanced nuclear subs, the so-called SSBN Typhoon class, has been transferred to the Chinese Navy, complete with a Russian crew. Meanwhile, the celebrated USS Cheyenne is in Taiwan's Tsuying Naval Base tonight. While the ship is being refitted for her next mission, her crew gets some well-deserved shore time. Jim Collins, TCN News.
The combat systems officer and engineer officer and their other division officers remained on board Cheyenne to take care of the weapons loading from McKee and reactor startup preparations. Captain Mackey, along with his executive officer, operations officer, and navigator, proceeded to the headquarters of the Tsui Ying Naval Base for their pre-underway briefing. They weren't sure why the briefing wasn't in Mackey's war room where the previous briefings had taken place.
They get the AV-20 under the rug there.
Upon entering the conference room on the second floor, Mack was happy to see that security personnel from the CTF-74 staff were conducting an electronic sweep of the room, hunting for listening devices.
Coming up negative.
After Cheyenne's officers arrived and before they could settle into their places, a couple of heavies preceded a distinguished Chinese gentleman who turned out to be President Jiang. The heavies were two of his bodyguards. Mack wasn't too sure about this. A war patrol briefing with the Chinese there? President Jiang approached, noting Mack's concerned expression.
Captain Mackey, do not be concerned. It is a pleasure to meet you.
How do you do, sir?
I am very well. Your meeting is taking place here because I wanted to meet a famous captain of the Cheyenne. On behalf of all my people, I would like to thank you. In every province of my country, in defiance of Li Peng, songs have been written about the Cheyenne and her heroic exploits.
Oh, well, thank you, sir. On behalf of the officers and crew of the Cheyenne, I'm honored.
When President Jiang had left, the briefing began. The Chinese had heard of Jiang's servicing in Taiwan, so they spent some of their dwindling currency on the purchase of a Russian-built Typhoon-class SSBN. The giant submarine had already completed its under-ice transit and was nearing the South China Sea. The briefing officer also mentioned that the Typhoon probably had some North Fleet Akula II SSNs riding shotgun. That was a waste, Mack thought to himself. The Typhoon's double-hull construction was not just for survival against torpedo attacks, but also to allow it to punch through the polar ice cap and launch its missiles with near impunity. The Cheyenne's Mark 48s would have to be accurately placed to damage the SSBN. Mack decided he would probably have to use some Mark 48s in the swim-out mode as off-board search sensors in the patrol area locations where naval intelligence estimated the Typhoon could be located. Naval intelligence, Mack knew, was basing its location estimates on its belief that the Typhoon's SSN-20 SLBMs, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, were not capable of short-range ballistic trajectories, like some of their earlier missile systems were. The Typhoon could launch at Taiwan from the Arctic Ocean, where it would require the United States to detect and track the missile trajectory. By the time it was determined where the missiles were headed, it would be too late. Mack decided that after today's reactor startup, Cheyenne would stay critical every time in port, so long as there was a threat of ballistic missiles. If the Typhoon launched, there would not be time to conduct pre-critical checks, reactor startup, and engine room light-off before the missiles detonated in the sky over the Soying Naval Base. When Mack and the other officers of Cheyenne returned to the ship, the combat systems officer reported the weapons loading complete, including two Harpoon missiles just in case. Mack wasn't happy that torpedo space was traded for Harpoons, but at least they weren't loaded in the torpedo tubes. After departing her mooring alongside McKee shortly after dark, Cheyenne got underway and headed to the north off of Kangshan on the surface. Since the Russian Rorsat satellites had been sweeping the area for the Chinese, the intent was to fool the satellites into believing that Cheyenne would be patrolling to the north, when actually she would be doing an end run around the east of Taiwan where the water was deeper. Cheyenne no longer had her running lights energized, nor the submarine ID beacon. She was running darkened ship. Once Cheyenne submerged, Mack reversed her course to the south. He had decided that the squeeze of the shallow water of the Formosa Strait would be too much if they continued to the north submerged. Besides, the Rorsat deception was overcome by events by now. If it didn't work, it didn't work. The rest was up to the Cheyenne's sonars and their extraordinary operators. After a day's quiet transit, Cheyenne arrived in the first patrol area. Located 200 nautical miles east of Macclesfield Bank, Mac had decided this would be the most likely typhoon patrol area. On arrival near the northeast corner of the area, Mac ordered the OOD to launch an SSXBT. This submarine bathy-thermograph device was designed to rise to the surface and then drop to the bottom, collecting data on temperature versus depth information through the water column. The information it gathered would be sent by wire to the Busy One computer for use by the sonar and fire control systems. It would also provide layered depth information, which Mac wanted. He could use that data to allow Cheyenne to effectively hide beneath the first thermal layer, or even a second deeper layer. During dinner in his wardroom, a dinner they all ate quickly, Mac addressed his officers.
We have our work cut out for us again. With quiet Akulas and the typhoon staring us in the face, we'll need to be innovative in our attacks. We'll have to flush out both the Akulas and the typhoon.
Cheyenne had gotten a break earlier. Sonar had reported weak tonals from an Akula to the south. The submarine was designated Master 124. The initial range had been established at roughly 80,000 yards in the third convergence zone by the Section Fire Control Tracking Party. There was still nothing from any other Akulas or the Typhoon. After dinner, Mac returned to the control room. Just in case the other Russian submarines were somewhere nearby, Mac passed an order for the torpedo room.
Make tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects, including opening the outer doors.
The Akula was not tracking on any particular course. To Mac, this meant he was loitering in the vicinity of the typhoon, just as he had hoped. He ordered battle stations manned, then sent out the now familiar command.
Firing point procedures, Master 124.
Target course is random, sir. Speed 3. Range 15,780 yards.
Sonar Khan, stand by.
Khan, sonar, standing by.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2. Aye, sir.
Tubes 1 and 2 fired electrically.
Con, sonar. Units from tubes 1 and 2 running hot, straight, and normal. The weapons are accelerating.
Cheyenne had detected a second Akula when it accelerated to flee the situation. But there was still no sign of the typhoon. The captain of the Typhoon, a capital ship of the former and perhaps future Soviet Union, was not about to reveal his position. He hovered quietly, with main engines secured and with his two pressurized water reactors at the lowest possible power. He had even secured the big craft's dual spinners, allowing his ship to swing with the current. This particular Russian captain intended to make admiral. The two Mark 48s from Cheyenne continued on course for their targets, but only the torpedo from Tube 1 had targeted the original Akula. Mac had retargeted the other Mark 48 at the second Akula as soon as it sped up, allowing Cheyenne's sonars to detect it.
Sonar, explosions bearing 195 and 178.
Mac was hoping that the loss of two of his Akula escorts would rattle the Typhoon captain, but he maintained his posture, quiet as a titmouse in a church. Mac knew the Typhoon was out there, but he hadn't flushed it yet. What Mac didn't know was that there was another Akula out there as well. The Akula, like the Typhoon, was refusing to be baited. Mac ordered a Mark 48 prepared for swim out and offboard sensor tactics, especially where the torpedo could seek out ice-picking SSBNs and send the information back to Cheyenne over the guidance wire. The search for the Typhoon took a while, with the Mark 48 probing the area ahead of Cheyenne, but eventually it paid off. The offboard sensor found the Typhoon, and the Typhoon's acoustic intercept receiver found the offboard sensor. On board the Typhoon, with a true belief in his invincibility, the Russian captain decided to remain in place. His only reactions to the sensor's presence were to operate his spinners, to twist his massive ship, and to ready his 65-centimeter and 53-centimeter torpedoes for use against the American submarine that had sent the Mark 48 hunting. The Russian captain had no way of knowing who was out there, but he decided it must be Cheyenne. The Typhoon's captain ordered the interlocks broken between the port and starboard tube nests, thereby allowing him to bring all his 53-centimeter torpedo tubes to bear at once. At the same time that the Typhoon was making its preparations, Captain Mackey was formulating his own new doctrine. This situation had never developed before, but it had its parallels, if one had the brains and the guts to see it.
Firing point procedures, master 126, tubes 1 and 2. Firing point procedures, master 126, tubes 3 and 4.
The combat systems officer and executive officer looked confused by Mac's order. Mac explained.
Unit 1 for the main screws. Then when they spin up on the spinners, units 2 and 3 for the spinners. When that happens, we'll be within range behind the Typhoon to light off Midas. Then we'll detonate unit 4 over their missile deck.
Midas stood for Mine Detection and Avoidance Sonar. Mac's gutsy plan went off without a hitch. Unit 1 ran to the Typhoon's screws as intended. When sonar reported the spinners starting up, the next two units were guided to their points of destruction. With the launch of the last two units from Cheyenne, the Russian captain finally decided to launch torpedoes at the American submarine and his missiles at Taiwan. But by then, it was too late. The fourth torpedo detonated above the missile deck before the first launch tube missile hatch could be opened. The result was the dishing in of all hatches so they couldn't be opened. In addition, the overpressure wave caused by the last Mark 48's 650 pounds of explosive, coupled with the Typhoon's depth and open torpedo tube muzzle doors, resulted in the Russian torpedo tube breech doors giving way. The torpedo room flooded and the Typhoon started to take on water. That would have finished just about any other submarine in the world, but not the Typhoon. With its double hull still intact, the would-be Russian admiral ordered all internal ballast dumped. Even if the outer ballast tanks were ruptured, the missile tube water compensation system would provide some buoyancy. The Typhoon accelerated rapidly to the surface, but once there, the Russians learned that the emergency escape capsule, which had never been tried out on a real submarine, could not be released. At that point, the Typhoon's captain decided to remain where he was to await rescue. Mac knew the Russian captain had lost his cool. He was now in the South China Sea where no Russian ships could come to his rescue. What's more, Cheyenne had finally picked up the last Akula whose captain had elected to distance his ship from the fray. Cheyenne was there waiting as the Typhoon reached the surface. The Russian boat had been severely damaged, but Mac ordered four more torpedoes into the defenseless giant. Mac's orders were clear. If he had allowed the Typhoon to survive, its crew would have cut the missile hatches open with blowtorches and completed their launch against Taiwan. The four torpedoes exploding beneath the Typhoon caused major seawater system flooding. Life rafts were put over the side, only to be attacked by the South China Sea shark population. The crew watched, helplessly, from the huge, flat missile tube deck. The oversized submarine started settling slowly deeper, the water level rising to within meters of the missile tube deck, with the crew topside. The captain, the admiral who would never be, had already sent a message to his North Fleet headquarters concerning the impending demise of his capital ship and the lack of help from his Akula escorts, two of which had been sunk. After that, he went topside to be with his men. They sat down and held hands in a circle as their submarine slid beneath the surface of the sea, sailors to the end for eternity. The sharks did the rest. When the Russian North Fleet headquarters received the message from the typhoon, the commander-in-chief was astounded, and not just at the loss of one of his strategic assets. He was also furious and astonished at what seemed to be a refusal to follow orders by one of his Akula captains. The scathing COI's only message received by the remaining Akula was clear. Its meaning was well understood by the Akula's captain, because it made reference to his family, his wife and two daughters, who had been taken into protective custody by the Russian Secret Service. Mac was nearing the periscope stand when sonar reported low-frequency tonal contact to the north. The tonals were classified by the sonar supervisor as coming from an Akula. They were weak, but closing. The Akula captain, intimidated by his own chain of command, had decided to take on Cheyenne. He'd had no choice. Even without the threat to his family, returning to his homeland without being successful during war, even if it was a Chinese war, was tantamount to certain death. He made two torpedoes ready for his own snapshots, in case they stumbled upon the quiet Cheyenne at close range. The Russian sonar operators were poised, carefully searching for any sign of Cheyenne with their towed array. They had all listened to the sounds of the deaths of their comrades on board the Akulas and the Typhoon, and they were eager to defeat Cheyenne. The Akula was nearing the outer weapon range of both the U.S. and the Russian torpedoes. Mac entered the control room.
Okay, men. It's time to man battle stations.
Mac had already expended 11 torpedoes, including the dead round he'd used as the offboard sensor. 13 Mark 48s and one lonely harpoon remained, and the harpoon would be of no use unless he could force the Akula to the surface. But Mac didn't want it to come to that. The Typhoon's death had been bad enough. Submariners, even the enemy, deserved to die with their ship rather than at the hands of the creatures of the sea. Once battle stations were manned, Captain Mackey passed an order for the torpedo room.
Make tubes 1 and 2 ready in all respects, including opening the outer doors.
In addition to making Cheyenne's tubes ready as early as possible, he intended to launch two Mark 48s in the quiet swim-out mode, as he had done with the offboard sensor, but this time they would be armed as weapons. The remaining Akula, with its own towed array, had shown that he could be a quiet adversary. Naval intelligence still had not learned much about that sensor capability, so Mac decided to play it safe. He decided to steer the torpedoes off target so they would be attacking from bearings other than Cheyenne's location. The Akula was tracking to the southwest. Cheyenne was closing the range, intending to intercept with a fire control solution before the Akula could reach detection range on Cheyenne. The Akula continued drawing left as Cheyenne closed. It, too, was otherwise quiet, with no contact on the spherical or conformal arrays. Because of this, the Busy One operators had to rely on the readings from the TB-23, assisted by Mac's course changes, to make the solution possible for the fire control party. When both they and the fire control coordinator were satisfied with the target motion analysis solution on Master 46, the Russian Akula, the captain ordered,
"Firing point procedures, Master 46.
The combat systems officer at the weapons control console reported on the Akula's heading.
"The target course is 200, speed 4, and range 27,250 yards.
Sonar, Khan, stand by.
Khan, sonar, standing by.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2.
Match sonar bearings and shoot tubes 1 and 2. Aye, sir.
Tubes 1 and 2 fired electrically.
Khan, sonar, units from tubes 1 and 2 running hot, straight, and normal."
The two torpedoes executed their wire clearance maneuvers and accelerated to slow speed with a long inbound run. Mac was pleased.
Very well, Sonar. Take charge and steer the weapons. Unit 1 off course 10 degrees to the right, and Unit 2 off course 45 degrees to the left.
When the torpedoes were close enough for passive acquisition, they would be steered back in the opposite direction. Minutes later, the torpedoes were turned on cue. One was leading the target, while the other was slightly lagging.
Time to acquisition?
10 minutes for Unit 2, Captain. 12 minutes for Unit 1.
Exactly on schedule, the combat systems officer reported that Unit 2 had acquired. 2 minutes later, Unit 1 did the same. Then, an unwelcome surprise.
Con, Sonar, we have 2 torpedoes in the water, bearing 205 and drawing right.
The Russian captain had launched his snapshots, but not at the bearings of the incoming torpedoes. He wasn't fooled by Mac's ploy. Instead, he had launched on a bearing halfway between the oncoming torpedoes, straight toward Cheyenne. Mac reacted swiftly.
Right full rudder, all ahead flank. Do not cavitate. Make your depth 1,000 feet.
He wasn't sure if the Akula had detected Cheyenne on its towed array, or if the Russian captain had guessed at Mac's tactic. If the Akula had heard them, it knew Cheyenne's location. But if its captain had just made a lucky guess, then Mac didn't want to reveal Cheyenne to its sonar. Not unless the inbound torpedoes acquired Cheyenne, and he had to. Cheyenne was at flank speed in less than a minute, on course due east and at 1,000 feet. Mac was keeping the torpedoes at the edge of his port baffles so sonar could continue to relay bearing information. A short while later, sonar's supervisor reported that the torpedoes were speeding up and drawing right. At the same time, the WLR-9, Cheyenne's acoustic intercept receiver, started chirping at the frequency of the incoming torpedoes.
Con, sonar, explosions coming from our baffles.
That was the sound of Cheyenne's 2 torpedoes exploding. Since the explosions occurred in her baffles, the sonar operators could not determine what effect, if any, they'd had on the Akula. But Mac couldn't worry about that at the moment. The enemy torpedoes were still out there and closing fast, and they were his top priority. Mac released 2 noisemakers and brought Cheyenne hard right again, circling to the south. Cheyenne's high-speed maneuvers created an additional knuckle that helped draw the attention of the Russian torpedoes, which attacked nothing but the boiling water column. Confused by the noisemakers, they could not acquire Cheyenne, but instead headed off into the sea. When the Russian torpedoes could no longer be heard, Mac turned to the west and slowed Cheyenne to search for the Akula. There was no contact on any of the arrays, and no reverberations from Cheyenne's torpedoes exploding. The Akula had vanished, but whether it had been destroyed or had merely gone back into hiding could not be determined with any degree of certainty. Mac took Cheyenne back toward Taiwan for reload, maneuvering her slowly and cautiously. Following the Navy's standard procedures, Mac's patrol report would list the last Akula as being sunk. Mac only hoped he was right.
TCN in Washington, this is a news brief. I'm Jim Collins. The crisis in China may be nearing its end tonight. Li Peng, who seized power in a coup 6 weeks ago, is suing for peace. A summit meeting between Li, China's president, and Jiang Zemin, the man Deng Xiaoping had chosen as his successor and who is supported by the U.S., is due to take place in Hong Kong this weekend. Li is reportedly ready to step down. At the same time, General Yu Kuili, the military strongman who helped Li gain power, does not support the peace process and remains adamantly opposed to negotiations. Admiral Jeb Thomas, former chief of naval operations, is with us again. Admiral Thomas, can General Yu still cause trouble in China?
Yes, he certainly can, and he almost certainly has, Jim. Last week, the submarines Portsmouth and Pasadena were hit by an unknown vessel. We don't know what it was, but it's evidence that General Yu still has loyal troops under his command, and that he is not following a path to peace. There are a lot of unknowns out there. Zhang still has to make the journey from Taiwan to the mainland. My sources tell me that in this tense atmosphere, the Pentagon is recommending to the President that Zhang should go by sea rather than by air, because safe air cover cannot be guaranteed.
Thank you, Admiral. Is this truly the end game, or do more moves remain in the deadly chess game in the South China Sea? The next days, even the next hours, may give us the answer. Jim Collins, TCN News.
Cheyenne arrived at daybreak, servicing off Soying Naval Base, the slow transit among the seemingly never-ending junks. During his last underway from Soying, Mac had remembered the war stories, both from World War II and Vietnam, where the same type of junks were carrying large-caliber machine guns. Mac tried to put that out of his mind. This situation, this entire war, was different, and he didn't believe that any of these Taiwanese junks posed a threat. Just in case, however, he had M-14s safely hidden away on the bridge while maneuvering on the surface in these waters. Mac was looking forward to the briefing. He wanted an update on several situations. He knew that the submarines Columbia and Bremerton were on station to provide additional ASW, or anti-submarine warfare, protection to the Independence Battle Group. In addition, the submarines Portsmouth and Pasadena had managed to make it safely to an area south of the Formosa Strait, having transited the Indian Ocean and South China Sea without opposition. Mac figured that was because General Yu was throwing everything at Cheyenne, east of Taiwan. Unfortunately, both SSNs were blindsided by an unknown submarine contact before they could surface at the 100-fathom curve. The hostile submarine tonals that both Portsmouth and Pasadena detected during the course of the attack did not correlate to any known submarine in the world, and Mac was very anxious to learn more about it. CTF-74 communications personnel had already readdressed each submarine's casualty report to Mac. The unknown assailant had inflicted major damage to each submarine's stern area. Their screws had several blades peened over, and both the TB-23 and TB-16 towed array housings were damaged. As Cheyenne arrived at McKee, Mac noted that Pasadena and Portsmouth had moored to port and starboard respectively, so they could be close for diver repair services. McKee's cranes were already busy working over both stern areas. The successful attacks had to have had a tremendous emotional impact on the crews of both Portsmouth and Pasadena, but Mac could see no sign of it. No one appeared demoralized, and they worked competently and professionally as if nothing had happened. On top of that, both submarines proudly sported their brow covers, telling the world which one was which, ship logos and all. The U.S. submarine force had long supported the policy of not painting hull numbers on the sides of the sail while operating, even in peacetime, so the brow covers provided the public relations gesture. Cheyenne was directed to moor outboard of Portsmouth. When they pulled into position, Mac could see that both Portsmouth's screw and the damaged portion of the TB-16 array housing at the starboard stern plane had already been replaced. These had suffered the least damage of the two sister ships. When final repairs were completed on Portsmouth's TB-23 towed array housing on the port side, Cheyenne would swap places with Portsmouth so that the McKee cranes could reach her for reloading weapons. Waiting on Portsmouth would delay Mac's next underway for at least an additional 2 days. But that was all right with Mac. His officers and crew, and Mac himself, needed some time to catch their breath. Besides, he had an indication of what their mission was going to be. If he was right, Cheyenne would have to wait a bit anyway, while the Chinese political situation caught up to them. As soon as Cheyenne's own brow cover was in place, Mac left the ship and was headed for McKee officer country. He expected to meet up with the COs of Pasadena and Portsmouth and to hear the details of the attacks. Seated around the briefing table, with cups of fresh coffee at their elbows, the COs of Pasadena and Portsmouth attempted to explain what had happened, but there simply wasn't much hard information they could provide. The first clue either of them had that they were in trouble was when they found torpedoes in their baffles. In both cases, neither of the torpedoes had gone active until it was too late, and they had detonated at a standoff distance. The skimpy bit of sonar data which had been collected over the towed arrays was only enough to determine that tonals from their attacker could not be correlated to any specifically known submarine. Mac wasn't surprised at that. The standard tonals, which correlated to nearly every Russian, Chinese, and Third World country ships, were little help in differentiating submarine classes. Plus, there was no screwblade information. Mac offered his assessment of the attacks.
Sounds like what saved you was a fire control placement or a detonation planning error. That would fit with Cheyenne's recent experiences. Newly built submarines with newly trained Chinese crews sent to attack experienced U.S. submarine crews.
CTF-74's admiral agreed with Mac, but he had a further question.
Mac, if the crews were so inexperienced, how did they detect Pasadena and Portsmouth? And in an aspect that allowed passive torpedoes to home undetected, for a while at least, on what must have been a reasonably good solution.
I hate to suggest it, Admiral, but maybe someone needs to go back and reevaluate our position on non-acoustic ASW. Were there any unusual Chinese or Russian aircraft in the area around that time?
Good point, Mac. I'll get that information for you. I'll try to get an answer before any of you put to sea again.
Mac hoped the Admiral could turn something up. He knew that the submarines would not wait for an answer before returning to their patrols. There was a threat out there, and Cheyenne and her sister ships would have to deal with it, whether they could put a name to it or not. While Mac was at his debriefing, discussing Cheyenne's recent patrols and learning what little information was available about his new threat, his officers and crew were overseeing Cheyenne's refit. The sonarmen on Pasadena and Portsmouth brought their last sonar tapes leading up to and following the torpedo explosions. These tapes were fed to Cheyenne's sonar consoles and her Busy One computer consoles. Cheyenne's sonar operators and Busy One operators put 7 different computer consoles to work analyzing the sparse data. They played the tapes over and over again, enhancing them with the computers each time and then starting the cycle again. They were even able to merge the tapes from both SSNs, a feat made possible by the accurate timekeeping systems on U.S. submarines. But they weren't able to learn anything useful. Then they got their first break. When the tapes were slowed down enough to produce subharmonics of the main electrical frequency line, the chief sonarman noted a warbling that could not be attributed to slowed tapes or even merged tapes. He had never heard that particular sound before, but he knew what it was, the sound of a previously unknown submarine. More than that, he knew that it had to be an anomaly of the new submarine's signature, which was masked at higher frequencies, even at the base frequency. In order to be certain, the chief sonarman, along with Cheyenne's executive officer and the sonarman from Pasadena and Portsmouth, applied this same technique to previous Cheyenne recordings of other Chinese and Russian submarines. They found no matches. This anomaly was new, and it was unique. Even better, it was a low, low frequency, something the TB-23 thin line array would thrive on if they let it search that low. When Mac was informed of the anomaly, he immediately dubbed it a slowly varying constant. He picked up that term in a pure math class, and it seemed more than appropriate for this war with the Chinese. It was several days before the McKee captain notified Mac that the next war patrol briefing would again be at the Naval Base headquarters. Mac, had expected that. He had been alerted earlier that Cheyenne had been selected as the obvious choice for this next, and hopefully last, mission. To move President Jiang into Chanjiang Naval Base. With all Cheyenne's preparations completed prior to the briefing, Mac decided to make it a nearly all-hands evolution. All officers definitely needed to be there, and with the promise of information on the new foe lurking out there, somewhere, waiting to take on the famous Cheyenne, the entire sonar division also needed to be present. And with President Jiang and his two heavies taking up berthing space, Mac invited the chief of the boat, or Cobb, to meet the space intruders. The Cobb also needed to figure out how to keep the president and his heavies out of sensitive spaces. Being on good terms with them would be easier than trying to force the cooperation of the heavies, especially since no one aboard Cheyenne could match the sheer bulk of Jiang's bodyguards. The Cobb already had formulated an initial plan. Lots of food, desserts, and movies in the goat locker. A lounge, mess area, and bunk room all rolled into one small but cozy space. Mac had already informed the executive officer to take care of the president himself. The executive officer's stateroom had two bunks, and so he would share his space with the Chinese leader. It had been difficult for Mac to agree for the detachment to be transferred prior to his patrol. He was concerned about possible non-acoustic ASW aircraft, and had agreed mostly because he knew that if Cheyenne remained fully submerged for the entire transit, they wouldn't be able to detect ESM contacts anyway. But he did add Cheyenne's ESM operators to the list of briefing attendees, just in case. The briefing turned out to be one for the books. As the briefing officer opened the meeting, she smiled at Mac.
Captain Mackey, our commander-in-chief sends his greetings.
She dimmed the lights and nodded for the videotape recorder to be started. Mac had half expected the briefing officer to be kidding or to be referring to someone else, but she wasn't. As Mac and the assembled officers looked on, the face of the President of the United States filled the screen. The chief executive spoke from the Oval Office.
Captain Mackey, the State Department will soon release a report of an impending summit between me, President Jiang Zemin, and Premier Li Peng in Beijing. Premier Li Peng is expected to relinquish his claim to power at that time. However, in all fairness to Cheyenne, no mention of your involvement in this historic event is authorized, at least not until you have successfully delivered the rightful Chinese president to Chanjiang Naval Base. Captain Mackey, the First Lady and I would like to wish you godspeed, fair winds, and a following sea. Good luck to you, and to the heroic men of the USS Cheyenne.
As the room lights brightened, everyone was talking with an excitement that was rare even in wartime mission briefings. The president hadn't really said anything that they didn't know about, but the simple fact of the president talking directly to them added to the importance of Cheyenne's mission. When the buzzing quieted down, the briefing officer continued with her presentation, and it didn't take her long to drop another bombshell.
You're probably all aware of the recent moves to decommission the USS Los Angeles, SSN 688. Well, decommissioning has been canceled. As I speak, the Los Angeles is nearly on station, south of the Formosa Strait. Her mission is to assist in escorting Cheyenne and President Jiang.
That was a serious mistake, Mac thought, but he kept his mouth shut. Los Angeles was the first of the 688s. He'd heard that her decommissioning had been postponed due to a lack of funds, but he didn't know that she still had enough crew left to even get underway, much less to fight the Chinese. On top of that, she had the old fire control and sonar systems and no TB-23 thin line array, which meant that Los Angeles had little chance to detect the new Chinese submarine. Mac was afraid she would be sunk before Cheyenne even got underway. That was bad news. Then it got even worse.
Captain Mackey, you will also be escorted by a Chinese North Sea Fleet, Alpha-class SSN, the Chung. The Chung's orders are to stay to the west and eventually to the north of a specially constructed track from the Formosa Strait to Chanjiang Naval Base and to proceed at 6 knots.
Outwardly, Mac didn't react at all. but he couldn't help thinking how quickly that Alpha would disappear at the hands of the hostile submarine. That didn't really matter, of course, he realized. Not as long as Chung stayed out of Cheyenne's sector as ordered. In fact, it might help to flush out the new foe, whatever it was. Mac would trade the Alpha for the new enemy submarine with pleasure. But Los Angeles, that was a different story. The two 688s could talk to and protect each other, but that would also be difficult at best. When the room once again quieted, the briefing officer finally got to the subject that Mac and his officers were most interested in, the new threat and what it might be.
According to the CIA, the unknown submarine is believed to be the culmination of recent Sino-Soviet research and development into a next-generation nuclear attack submarine. Deployment of the Mao, as the CIA believes it to be called, had not been expected any time soon. But now, with the damage inflicted upon Portsmouth and Pasadena and the evidence of the sonar tapes, it's pretty clear that the Mao is out there, waiting for Cheyenne.
When it looked like the briefing officer had no more to say on the subject, Mac asked the other question he desperately needed answered.
What about the non-acoustic ASW?
The briefing officer was prepared for the question, but not with the answer Mac wanted.
Sorry, Captain. CIA still doesn't believe that an aircraft can use lasers to detect submerged objects and to communicate with their submarines.
Mac hated that answer. He hated it because the answer wasn't, the CIA checked this out and found no evidence. Instead, the answer was simply, the CIA cannot believe this and so they won't check it out. Mac changed the subject.
We sank a Hainan-class mine layer and a mine-laying Romeo on our last patrol. Could either or both of them have laid mines near Chanjiang Naval Base before they proceeded up the coast from Mandarin Bay?
Chinese minesweepers have scoured that area, Mac. It's clean.
The other COs in the room seemed satisfied with that answer, but Mac wasn't so sure. He would have felt better if the minesweeper had found some mines and disposed of them. Either way, though, he knew that there might be mines strewn along the last leg of Cheyenne's route. They would simply have to take appropriate precautions, either with the Midas or an off-board sensor. If, that is, any Mark 48s remained by the time they entered that last hazard zone, the shallow water leg en route to the Chanjiang Naval Base. 3 hours after the briefing was over, President Jiang and his two heavies were led below decks on Cheyenne by the executive officer and the Cobb. Cheyenne's underway was uneventful, and the M-14s Mac had on the bridge stayed safely in their racks. After submerging, Mac ordered the OOD to stream the floating wire. He also ordered the TB-23 towed array deployed far enough to ensure that the 960 feet of hydrophones were clear of their housing. After that, Cheyenne headed for the 300-fathom curve which she would follow at the established 6-knot speed of advance until she was due east of the Chanjiang Naval Base. Then she would have nearly 300 miles of westerly transit across the widest part of the continental shelf, all in less than 100 fathoms of water. The Chinese Alpha, Chung, was presumably inboard of Cheyenne, where it belonged, more than 20,000 yards away according to its sector restrictions, and Los Angeles was outboard in the deeper water to the east, where she could remain until the turn to the west. Mac's biggest concern was the Mao. The TB-23 was their best bet for detecting it, and if they didn't encounter the unknown submarine before they had to switch to the TB-16 towed array, they could be in trouble. A day and a half later, as Cheyenne was nearing the turning point, sonar reported several conformal array submarine contacts to the northwest, two at high speed on converging bearings. Mac manned battle stations and launched one of the several submarine satellite information exchange system, or SysX buoys, with prearranged reports that he'd ordered just in case something like this were to happen. That was the safest way to communicate events to Los Angeles. SysX to CTF-74 for turnaround to Los Angeles for copying on her floating wire. By the time battle stations were manned, sonar had four contacts to the northwest. Only one was the Chung, as determined by the Alpha tonals. The other three were Akulas. The Chung was also communicating by underwater telephone, which was being answered by only one Akula. Without a Chinese linguist aboard, or a Russian one for that matter, Mac could only guess at what was being said, but he assumed that the Chung captain was trying to talk himself out of a bad situation. The Chinese captain's answer came in the form of three torpedoes, one from each of the three Akulas, which were tracking on the bearing of the still-squawking Chung. Mac shook his head. The Chung captain had not been inept. He had been ambushed by three of his fellow commanding officers who were under the command of the still-at-large General Yu Kui Li, and he had done the best he could against them. His talking with the Akulas on the underwater telephone may have given his position away, but it also gave his Akula submarine fire control system the ranges and bearings of the Chinese bullies. He managed to launch two of his ET-80 torpedoes before the Chung was hit by three 65-centimeter torpedoes. The Cheyenne control room and sonar room were in total silence as they witnessed the carnage. They had seen their share of enemy ships destroyed, but there was something about the spectacle of Chinese submariners killing themselves that made this especially poignant. Five explosions and four submarines had been involved in the fray, and only one Akula survived it unscathed. After the explosions, Mac turned to the south to head for the 500-fathom curve where he could fully deploy the TB-23. He hoped that the rapid turnaround promised by the CTF-74 communicators had happened by now. The Sissix boy instructions were for moving haven changes to the south for both Cheyenne and Los Angeles. Los Angeles had already received the instructions and had executed the turn as directed, not knowing that she was heading directly toward the Mao. The Sino-Russian hybrid submarine was laying in wait 30 degrees to the left of her track, expecting the attacking Akulas to cause Cheyenne to turn away to the south. The Mao captain did not know that the Los Angeles was in the area. So when the Mao gained sonar contact, he assumed that it was Cheyenne and the notorious Captain Mackey. Within minutes, four Mao torpedoes were heading in a depth and azimuth spread at the target. Los Angeles got off a snapshot. Then she launched countermeasures, turned away toward deep water and increased speed to flank en route to 1,000 feet. The Mao captain had expected this. He had read the reports from the few surviving commanding officers who had tangled with Mac, and he felt he knew the Americans' tactics. Even before Los Angeles launched countermeasures, the Mao captain was swinging his submarine to starboard. As soon as his ship was in position, he launched four more torpedoes, leading the USSSN perfectly. He had sprung his trap exactly as he'd hoped. And if the ship he had targeted had indeed been Cheyenne, Mac's ship would have been destroyed. Cheyenne's sonars had picked up the first set of torpedo launches from the Mao. The noise from the second set finalized the range, bearing, and course. Mac launched two Mark 48s from tubes 1 and 2, and followed them with two more from tubes 3 and 4. The Mao captain was too busy listening in the direction of his own torpedoes and the frantically racing Los Angeles to notice that four Mark 48 ADCAPs were inbound for his position. Cheyenne's first two torpedoes acquired the Mao just as the first two Chinese torpedoes struck Los Angeles. The Mao never heard Mac's weapons, as the remaining two Mark 48s acquired the hostile submarine at the same time Los Angeles was finally destroyed by the last four Mao torpedoes. The sound of the explosion was incredible, and more than the Cheyenne sonarmen could withstand. They all took off their headsets and watched their sonar consoles illuminate. Mac kept all hands at battle stations and proceeded to take Cheyenne to test depth as a salute to their lost shipmates aboard Los Angeles. Mac didn't have to say anything to the crew. They knew. The sound of the explosions through the hull told them at least one submarine had died out there. The down angle as Cheyenne headed for test depth told them who it had been. Only President Jiang and his two heavies didn't understand, and Mac was in no mood to tell them. The ocean was now quiet, except for the occasional hull popping, the Cheyenne slowly descended, heading south toward the safety of deep water. Only when she had leveled out at test depth did Captain Mackey pick up the 1MC. He'd always thought holding memorial services for a lost crewman was the hardest job he'd ever face. But this, conducting memorial services for an entire ship, was much, much harder. Then Cheyenne pitched slowly to a gentle up angle, and her hull started popping again as Mac came shallower, turning back to the north to look for the last Akula. He wouldn't find it, though. The explosions of the other two Akulas had caused enough overpressure damage that the last Akula captain had been forced to emergency surface and to limp from the area. As Cheyenne approached the time for coming shallow near the shelf, sonar reported numerous merchant ship contacts, but still no submarine contacts. As usual, biologics hindered the search, and they could not gain any contact on an Akula as Cheyenne entered the shallow water, heading west to deliver her precious cargo. Battle stations were secured and both towed arrays were housed at the 100-fathom curve. Mac had the feeling that Cheyenne had faced her last opponent and that they were out of trouble, but he didn't let his guard down. It was only a feeling, and he knew he still needed to be on the lookout for mines. Finally back at periscope depth, Mac sent his message traffic concerning the battles and the loss of Los Angeles. The ESM operator reported communications from a Chinese HF radio to the north. Acting on a previous thought which he had kept to himself, Mac asked if the Chinese president would mind translating something for him. When the tape of the comms was delivered to the wardroom and played for President Jiang, a smile spread quickly over his face.
Captain Mac, that is the commanding officer of the last of Yu's Akulas. He reported he was damaged, and he is heading for Zhengjiang Naval Base on the surface to ask for amnesty from the Jiang Zemin government for himself and his men.
Since the weather was calm, Mac decided to surface Cheyenne and follow the Akula into Chanjiang Naval Base. This time he allowed President Jiang on the bridge, giving him a handheld HF radio, so that he could act as an interpreter for Mac in discussions with the Chinese captain of the Akula.
Akula Commander, this is Captain Bartholomew Mackey of the USS Cheyenne. I will follow you into port from your stern. Be advised that I have one Mark 48, one Harpoon, and one Tomahawk anti-ship missile trained directly at you.
Cheyenne steamed safely into the naval base and delivered her cargo, and then made a slow transit back to Zuoying. En route, the news came that China had formally declared a ceasefire. The war was over. The United States, with the help of Cheyenne, had won. Mac heard the news with a mixture of joy and sadness. Joy that his crew was safe once more, with nothing more than the hazards of the deep to worry about, and sadness at the cost. For however long he remained at sea, the memory of those lost remained burned within his heart.
From TCN in Washington, this is a news update. I'm Jim Collins. The return of a hero tops our news tonight. In ceremonies at the White House, the President today awarded the Medal of Honor to Captain Bartholomew Mackey, commanding officer of the USS Cheyenne. Captain Mackey's now famous submarine was the single force in Southeast Asia which literally destroyed the Chinese infrastructure of submarines, accounting for over 60 authenticated kills, without sustaining any damage to his own ship. Prior to the event, Captain Mackey was promoted to Rear Admiral in an unprecedented meeting of Congress. The last time Congress made such a special promotion was for Admiral Hyman G. Rickover, the father of United States Navy nuclear propulsion. Following the White House ceremony, Rear Admiral Mackey and his wife left for the cold and snow of upstate New York, intending on taking part in the Lake Champlain submarine team races, known as Frostbite 97. After that, according to a CIA source, America's newest war hero and his wife plan to spend 2 weeks skiing at their chalet. The CIA said the source is deemed reliable since his family is taking care of the Mackey children. And there you have it. So much for CIA secrecy. Jim Collins, TCN News.
Listening to Tom Clancy, SSN. It was based on the CD-ROM from Simon & Schuster Interactive. Tom Clancy, SSN, was narrated by Joe Morton, with Boyd Gaines as Captain Mac Mackey, and John Beach, Jesse Boggs, Chad Coleman, Chris Lynch, Zoe McKay, Richard Poe, Michael Rosenbaum, Deborah Valcourt, and Lou Yu. It was adapted for audio by Jesse Boggs. The recording engineers were Jocelyn Gonzalez, Michael Jones, and Leszek Wojcik. Editing by Rick Bradley. Tom Clancy SSN sound effects designed by Soundelux Media Labs. Music composed by Joel Goldsmith and Dennis McCarthy. Special thanks to retired Commander Craig Etka, United States Navy. The associate producer was Sloan Seaman. Tom Clancy, SSN, was produced and directed by Karen Pearl. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Tom Clancy's The Sum of All Fears, Clear and Present Danger, and Cardinal of the Kremlin. Tom Clancy, SSN, is available in CD-ROM from Simon & Schuster Interactive.